Good evening. It's 37 years since the bombing of MOVE. We talk about that with Pam Africa. Race and South Georgia. Was it driving while black? A school bus full of students and team members is pulled over and searched by police. And Ukraine, $40 billion. When's it going to come? Is it going to come? And we talk with Walden Bellow, who was a candidate for president of the Philippines. He talks about his candidacy and the situation in the Philippines. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, May 13th, a very lucky day, 2022. It was 37 years ago today. The police in Philadelphia flew a helicopter over a house at 6221 Osage Avenue and dropped a bomb, killing 11 people, including 5 children. The entire, although mostly forgotten today, it was at the time watched live on nationwide television.
It's 5:27 p.m. State police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion.
What you're looking at now is a live picture of the water cannons pouring high-pressure streams of water onto the top of the MOVE house.
War in America. Long-standing tensions between MOVE, a black liberation group, and the Philadelphia Police Department erupted horrifically on that day. The city used a police helicopter and dropped the satchel bomb, a demolition device typically used in combat, laced with Tovex and C4, both plastic explosives, on the MOVE organization, who were living in the West Philadelphia row home known to be occupied by men, women, and children. It went up in unextinguished flames. The fire quickly spread, destroying 61 homes and leaving 250 people homeless. Only two people survived the bombing, Ramona Africa, then 29, and a child, Birdie Africa, then 13, later known as Michael Moses Ward. Both were badly burned. Despite two grand jury investigations, a civil suit, and a commission, final report decided the bombing as reckless, ill-conceived, and hastily approved. No one was ever criminally charged for the attack. Survivor Ramona Africa immediately went on to serve 7 years in prison on rioting and conspiracy charges for arrest warrants before the bombing. And here is, I believe it's Pam speaking today. I'm sorry, it's Ramona. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
I'm the only adult survivor, and I know that didn't happen for no reason at all. John Africa gave me information to put out to people, which I've been doing ever since May 13th of 1985. I just want to make the point that my MOVE 9 sisters and brothers went to prison for a total of 900 years for a murder they didn't commit, the murder of a cop named James Rank. But May 13th of 85, when this government murdered 11 MOVE people and countless dogs, nobody went to jail. Nobody. You know, I want to point out that there were over 500 police and officials out there. The firefighters were out there. The thing is, they shot over 10,000 bullets at us in less than 10 minutes. When that didn't work, they turned the deluge hoses on us, trying to force us out of the house. When none of that worked, they dropped a bomb on MOVE people. They tried to kill everybody in that house. I can't explain how devastated I was and other MOVE people were, the MOVE 9, who had children in that house. Long live John Africa.
And that was Ramona Africa. MOVE is a political and religious organization whose principles were anti-government, anti-technology, and anti-corporation. Its creator, John Africa, was a West Philadelphia native and Korean War veteran whose ideology combined black revolutionary ideas with environmental and animal rights as well as a back-to-nature movement. Members lived communally and described themselves as family, changing their last names to Africa out of reverence for their founder and for the continent. They engaged in animal rights and other types of protests, largely nonviolent but disruptive. In 1978, the notorious racist mayor of Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo, made the group enemy number one and sicked the cops on the group, leading to the tragedy that occurred in 1985. And Delaware Attorney General Kathleen Jennings requested the U.S. Department of Justice investigate after a Delaware State University bus was stopped and searched in Liberty County, Georgia. Liberty County in coastal Georgia is about 260 miles from Atlanta. A deputy stopped the bus claiming the driver was violating a state law requiring buses to travel only in the two right-hand lanes of the highway. The coach of the women's lacrosse team at the predominantly black university believes South Georgia deputies racially profiled her team during the April 20th traffic stop. Here's the audio from the deputy's body cam.
There's a bunch of dang schoolgirls on the bus. There's probably some weed. Maybe. He seems a little talkative. I will tell you guys, the reason why I'm coming on the bus right now is to tell y'all, look, we're gonna check y'all's luggage. Okay? If there is anything in y'all's luggage, we're probably gonna find it. Okay? I'm not looking for a little bit of marijuana, but I'm pretty sure you guys, the chaperones, probably going to be disappointed in you if we find any. You guys were on a lacrosse team, correct? So if there is something in there that is questionable, please tell me now. Because if we find it, guess what? We're not going to be able to help you.
And that's the deputy sheriff, from the audio from his body cam during that stop on April 20th in South Georgia. The lacrosse team's coach said six white deputies and a police dog searched the bus for drugs and found none. The sheriff says he believes the stop was legal as cops were supposedly looking for drugs and human trafficking along Interstate 95. Here's a lesson in that kind of situation. Always, STFU, don't talk. Just wait for your lawyer. In war news, the Pentagon's top spokesperson, John Kirby, said today Congress must pass a proposed $40 billion Ukraine supplemental aid package by Thursday to avoid an interruption of U.S. weapons shipments.
With the authorities we have left, $100 million we have left, that will help us get more assistance into Ukraine by about the third week of this month, towards the end of the month. So we really would like to get this approved quickly so that, again, we can continue to source additional drawdown packages and without interruption. We've been moving at a fairly fast clip here, both in terms of the individual packages that have been approved and how fast that stuff is getting on into Ukrainian hands. And we would literally every day there are things going in, and we would like to be able to continue that pace for as long as we can. Without additional authorities, we begin to not have the ability to send new stuff in. No decision yet on the $100 million. I think a decision will be coming soon on that, as we urge the Congress that by the 19th of May that it'll start impacting our ability to provide aid uninterrupted. It doesn't mean that on May 20th nothing goes in. I mean, because we're still filling out the last package is still arriving. So it doesn't mean that, you know, come 19, 20 May, everything stops. But
you won't have everything from the last packages by the 19th.
That's correct.
May.
But we do want, Court, we would like to have the cushion of being able to fill out additional packages in a completely uninterrupted way. Because eventually, if you don't get those authorities soon, if we don't get those authorities soon, I mean, it's possible that there could be a bubble, a period of time at which, you know, there's just nothing moving, and we want to make sure we avoid that. Yeah. Orrin, did you have...
and that is John Kirby. He's the Pentagon's top spokesperson. Earlier this week, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, along with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, sent a letter to House and Senate leadership asking for the money by the end of the week if we are able to continue our security assistance at the current pace, it said. The House on Tuesday passed a supplemental package for Ukraine, but the Senate was unable to do so after Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, blocked the bill's passage over demands that there be more oversight on how the money will be spent. And Russian punk rock band Pussy Riot performed live on Thursday at Funkhaus Berlin after a three-year hiatus. The band was catapulted to fame when the four members stormed into a cathedral in Moscow and performed a punk rock prayer begging the Virgin Mary to chase Putin away. They were dragged off the altar and subsequently charged with hooliganism. Several of them spent up to 2 years in jail. The band and its members have been arrested on multiple occasions since. Recently, Maria Alyokhinina, head activist of Pussy Riot, managed to escape Russia, dressed as a food courier. On Thursday evening, Pussy Riot kicked off their European tour in Berlin to raise money for Ukraine. And last week, voters in the Philippines elected Ferdinand Marcos Jr., known as Bongbong Marcos, the son of a notorious dictator, to a six-year term as president of the Western Pacific nation that was once a U.S. colony. Incumbent President Rodrigo Duterte was ineligible for re-election because a president is limited to a single term under the 1987 Philippine Constitution. Incumbent Vice President Lenny Robredo was eligible for re-election but chose to run for the presidency instead. One of the plethora of minor party candidates in the race was Walden Bello, who got his PhD in sociology from Princeton in 1975 and is known as one of the most effective people's organizers in the Pacific region. Bello decided to run for the presidency under the Partido Lakas Maza. He got 100,000 votes and spoke about the campaign with WBAI from Manila.
A candidate together with a labor leader named Leonie de Guzman, and we ran on a democratic socialist platform. One of the aims was to prevent what we call the axis of evil, meaning Marcos Jr. and his running mate, Sara Duterte, from coming to power. Secondly, we really wanted to begin popularizing a socialist workers program because the situation here for a long, long time has been that the left felt that it would not be able to run on an independent candidacy and really had to be part of a minor partner of reformist liberal coalition. So it was important for us to show that that kind of strategy no longer was viable and that a socialist candidacy was viable, or at least that we had to start winning people to it at this point. We ran on a shoestring budget, couldn't really compare to the millions of dollars from the elite. Nevertheless, part of the reason is people would tell us, quite frankly, that there is really this danger of Marcos, the son of the dictator, coming back to power. We didn't win, but in terms of our second objective, really popularizing democratic socialism, that it was a smashing success.
How many votes did you get?
Leonie got something like 92,000 votes, and I got nearly 100,000 votes. Those numbers don't really reflect the situation in the sense that quite a number of people really wanted to go with us, but they voted for Robredo, who was the reformist liberal kind of.
Bello goes on to explain how Philippine voters chose a family known to have led a kleptocracy in the past.
There hadn't been a good job in terms of really telling the youth, the young people, that about what happened, you know, during the Marcos years, which were nightmare years. So over 50% of the electorate were either small children when Marcos was ousted in 1986, or they were born after the that uprising, the EDSA uprising in 1986. Surely, there's part of the explanation is they really didn't know, experience what happened. So they were very susceptible to the Marcos propaganda that on the internet that painted the Marcos years, golden years, instead of years of nightmare. But I think that's the larger part is that for the last 36 years, ever since Marcos was ousted, there's really been no improvement in the lives of the lower classes, especially of youth. Part of it is because we had a string of governments supported by the United States, the World Bank and the IMF that imposed neoliberal policies that really devastated manufacturing and agriculture and resulted in the loss of jobs. A lot of these young people grew up in a society where the only way forward economically was to go abroad. Secondly, there was really no change in the structures of inequality. The situation in the Philippines is just as unequal at the end of the Marcos regime, and you've got a poverty rate of about 25% of the population, in extreme poverty, and close to 40% in a broader definition of poverty. People express their resentment in the polls. There's an element by which this was a protest vote against post-Marcos period of elite democracy, democracy among the elites in terms of competition, but no real change. Even the competing elites always united, had a united front against any sort of social reform. That was, in many ways, it was a protest vote against the status quo, element of a generational rebellion usually is harnessed by the left, which points to a better future from the present. Unfortunately, this one was harnessed by the Marcoses looking towards the past, the idea that there was a golden age that needed to be retrieved, which was, that was the Marcos propaganda. Now, just begs the question, of course, what happened to the left? And unfortunately, the left, who should have provided the rallying cry for discontented youth, really had been in a very poor state. There were a lot of splits in the left. The level of political imagination was really quite weak. There was always this sense that they had to be part of ruling elite coalition, the left wing of a ruling elite coalition, in order to be able to make headway. By the time we ran, and this just shows that when we ran on an independent platform and in fact gained a lot of support, this just proved the left can offer something very attractive to people. Unfortunately, it was a bit too late. Okay, we should have run this about a couple of years ago, 5 to 10 years ago. But we ran it in October of last year against the advice of many people. But we told them afterwards that, look, people are really responding. If we just had more time, we could have made a bigger difference at this point.
The United States' role in all this, and because there's been talk that the Marcos Jr. might be leaning towards China more.
It's not going to be a repeat of Duterte. Marcos is, you know, he's not somebody that ran on a war on drugs. In fact, he ran on no platform at all except we all have to unite. You know, the country has been so destroyed by our disunities, and let's talk about the good things in life. Sociologists here call it toxic positivity because it was built on an appeal to amnesia. Let's forget all about what happened during my father's reign. Let's just look at the good things in life. And that worked. I hate to admit it, but that worked. They refused to participate in any of the debates, both and his running mate, Sara Duterte, the son, the daughter of Duterte, and because they would be exposed as having no program. So I think that what's going to happen will be a kind of pragmatic kind of program that will probably have a number of populist elements. I don't think that there'll be strong stress on killing people by the drug war, but I think there will be, the program is going to be thought up from day to day. I'm looking forward to be part of the opposition for the next 6 years, and it's going to be very exciting. It's tragic, but it's also exciting.
Walden Bellow, the U.S. Socialist Worker, described Bellow as one of the most articulate and prolific voices on the international left, and that he has devoted most of his life to fighting imperialism and corporate globalization. Bellow was also a supporter of Hugo Chavez and was impressed by his opposition to the United States, stating after Chavez's death that he was a class act, one impossible to follow. wherever you are right now, he said, give them hell. And in national news, the sponsor of a bill that would have subjected Louisiana women to murder charges for having abortions abruptly pulled the proposal from debate last night after House members voted 65-26 to totally revamp the legislation, eliminating the criminal penalties. The controversial bill would have ventured farther against abortion than lawmakers' efforts in any other state. It would have made women who end their pregnancies subject to criminal homicide prosecutions. Meanwhile, on the steps of the Capitol, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Representatives Barbara Lee and Veronica Escobar of California joined other members to demand action to defend abortion rights.
Democrats are here on the steps of the United States Capitol, across from the Supreme Court, to say to the Supreme Court and to the Senate, hands off women's reproductive health care.
Yes. Yes. This is personal for many of us. It's personal for me because I know firsthand what being denied access to legal abortion looks like. I personally experienced the fear, the stigma, the trauma, the despair of being denied the care that you need. I know what it's like to have your medical decisions criminalized, to be forced to travel for the care that you need, and to see your future hang on the decisions of politicians rather than doctors.
Make no mistake, once Republicans shred long-standing precedent and privacy rights, they intend to wage an all-out assault on more of our rights,
right,
including access to contraception,
right,
and marriage equality.
We need you in November and every single day as we march to the polls and we expand our majority and we expand that majority over there. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
The scene on the steps of the Capitol earlier today. And Republicans are watching conservative candidate Kathy Barnett's sudden rise in their party's upcoming Pennsylvania United States Senate primary with a mix of unease, wonder, and dread. Barnett's late surge in the closely watched contest has turned what was broadly seen as a two-person race between celebrity doctor Mehmet Oz and former hedge fund manager Dave McCormick into a chaotic three-person affair, with Barnett seen as a wild card who has grassroots momentum mere days before the Tuesday contest. The unexpected development has caused even the most influential Republicans to panic, including former President Donald Trump himself, who attempted to quash Barnett's campaign by claiming in his statement yesterday that she's not a viable general election candidate. A political science professor from Muhlenberg College is Chris Borick. He had this to say.
That has emerged in a lot of the polls in a statistical dead heat with McCormick and Oz. Part of that is that over the last 3 months, McCormick and Oz have gone after each other in with extensive ad campaigns that have really attacked their weaknesses. Oz is a Hollywood liberal. McCormick is a hedge fund manager who's had relations with China. Those ads have been omnipresent, and I think it's brought down their standing and opened a door for an alternative. And Barnett, she's a fixture in conservative media circles. We've watched over the last few weeks, you know, President Trump's endorsements are testing his place in, you know, Republican politics right now, and the record has been mixed. He went out, I would say, on a limb with Mehmet Oz. You know, Oz is you know, he's a celebrity, but is not necessarily an easy slam dunk fit in Pennsylvania. So it's going to be an interesting test of the president's poll within the party. I do believe he sent Oz a lifeline, that if he didn't have Trump's blessing, his standing in the race would be much less than it is right now. Will it be enough? And if he does pull through, you can imagine this will be a crown jewel in Trump's endorsements. If he fails, it will be a pretty high-profile failure.
And that is a political science professor from a college in the region. The unexpected development of Barnett's late surge has sorry about that. We're going to skip that and go next to the next story. Well, Mayor Eric Adams said we should be very afraid of what will happen if the Supreme Court rules that New York City doesn't have the right to control guns in the way that it expected to. And he expressed that again today. at a news conference.
After what we saw the Supreme Court did on abortions, we should be very afraid. In a densely populated community like New York, this ruling could have a major impact on us. And so we are now looking with our legal experts to see what we can do, how we would curtail the behavior, our transit system around our schools. And so we are really trying to figure out what powers we have based on the Supreme Court ruling. But we should all be concerned.
That's the mayor. The Supreme Court is expected to hand down a decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association Incorporated versus Bruen in June. The pending ruling comes as New York and other big cities throughout the country battle a spike in gun violence since the start of the pandemic. And Adams, a former police captain, has made combating gun violence a focal point of his new administration. The case rests on whether it is constitutional for New York to deny someone a permit to carry a firearm. Currently, the state's rigorous application process for a license to carry prevents most people from doing so unless they show a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community. In hearings last fall, the Supreme Court justices' questions indicated they are leaning towards a win for the two men at the center of the case, Robert Nash and Brandon Koch, who say their constitutional rights were violated when New York denied them a license to carry. And today was last day for Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, who carried out the job with a grace and aplomb that was much different than her predecessors under the Trump administration. She broke down a little bit into tears as she told about the last 15 months and her happiness. I don't know whether to stay or leave.
Whew, I promised myself I was going to keep it together. I'm not. This is the last part of this. I want to thank all of you in this room. You have challenged me. You have pushed me. You have debated me. And at times we have disagreed. That is democracy in action. That is it working. Without accountability, without debate, government is not as strong. And you all play an incredibly pivotal role. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for making me better. And most importantly, thank you for the work every day you do to make this country stronger. And I am very grateful to all of you as well. So thank you for your role and to the role of your colleagues here and around the world. Okay. With that, Zeke, go ahead.
And she will be replaced. That was her last day by Karine Jean-Pierre, an African-American woman, and I believe the first African-American woman to hold the position of White House press secretary. And that's some of the news for Friday, May 13, 2022. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
Peace, peace, y'all. I'm BrewX Boogie, representing Bronx-based DJ Collective, Uptown Vinyl Supreme. And every Friday on this station, the Harlem Connection celebrates artists and genres that helped establish Harlem as a cultural mecca. But this week is Bronx Week, and my Uptown Vinyl Supreme crew has been invited to come on board as guest musical conductors. So we hope that you'll join us and tune in this Friday night at 10 p.m. as we ride together and play 100% vinyl of the music that gives us life. Pull up to the station for all that and more right here on the Harlem Connection.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and it's time for Real World.